This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you November 29th, 2005. Israeli soldiers had been flying for several hours before the assault helicopters reached their target, the uranium enrichment plant at Natanz in central Iran. Most of the men from the Shaldag battalion were dressed in the uniform of the Iranian Pasdaran militia, while others wore Israeli army kit and carried the standard issue M4A1 carbine rifle fitted with Trijicon reflex sights. As the helicopters dropped low over the desert, the commandos adjusted their night vision equipment. At the back of one craft, two large dogs from the Okitz unit strained against tightly held leashes. Close by were packs of explosives that would be strapped to them. As the choppers landed several miles from the target, the soldiers split out and ran to lorries hidden by Mossad agents. The Okitz men strapped the bombs to the dogs. As the lorries approached a dimly lit installation minutes later, snipers picked off seven guards at its entrance. The trucks thundered through the gates and headed for the gas centrifuges used to generate weapons-grade uranium. The soldiers fanned out, shooting and planting explosives. The dogs were sent down narrow tunnels leading deep into the bowels of the complex. 10 minutes passed. A series of explosions went off underground. Moments later, Israeli F-15 jets screamed in, dropping bunker buster bombs. The attack proceeded flawlessly. This time, it was a dress rehearsal. The thieves fall out over Iran. Uncivil war within the ruling class. Today on Taking Aim. And what I have been reading came from the Sunday Times of London, March 13, 2005, an article by Uzi Manemi and Tony Allen's Mills, Taking Aim at Iran. Ralph?
The article prepares us for what is called an all-out attack, elite Israeli commandos training now for the assault on Iran's nuclear facilities. Although publicly committed to a diplomatic effort, Israeli officials state that the point of no return will come later this year. Ariel Sharon's inner cabinet has already decided to act alone. So, in the tradition of Israeli military adventurism, including the destruction of Iraq's Osirak nuclear reactor in 1981 and the raid on Entebbe in Uganda, the article continues, Jerusalem is prepared for another daring strike. So what is really going on amid the barren emptiness of the Negev Desert? Is Israel really girding for battle as they prepare and rehearse the attack on Iran? The preservation of a nuclear monopoly in the Middle East is the cornerstone of Israeli security policy, stated John Pike, the weapons specialist with Global Security Org. It is Iran which is behind Israel's torments. The article is central in explaining and in demonstrating that the long-standing plan to dismantle each state within the Middle East now has Iran in the gun sights.
Ralph, it also makes the point that Israel was not always so worried about Iran's nuclear program. In the mid-1970s, Israeli scientists arrived at the Amirbad Research Center in Tehran to help with laser enrichment of uranium. But that was another age, notes the reporters, when the Shah sat on the peacock throne and Israeli El Al flights were welcomed twice a week to Tehran. Today, the Israelis are forced to look from the outside in, and Israeli special forces have been operating a listening post close to the Iranian border in Iraqi Kurdistan. They've also deployed intelligence-gathering submarines in the Gulf, remember that Iran faces the Gulf, and Iran is close to Kuwait. And with these intelligence gathering submarines in the Gulf, they've sent special forces on spying missions deep into Iran, and the U.S. has done so too. The Israeli Ofik 6 spy satellite, previously used to monitor Saddam Hussein's Iraq, has been moved to an Iranian orbit. And all of this, the Israelis are said to be coordinating with American forces.
I think that's the key, Maya. This article makes very clear any air-launched attack on Iran will send Israeli airplanes over Turkey, close to the Iraqi airspace, controlled by the Pentagon. Washington and Jerusalem know that whoever carries out the attack, the world will see it as a joint conspiracy. And indeed, so it is.
One thing about this report from the London Times is the claim that Iraq is producing nuclear weapons. Now, Iran is producing nuclear weapons. Iran has a nuclear facility, and it has been building one and only one nuclear power plant, and that was constructed by the Russians, an $800 million nuclear power plant, the construction of which was finished only recently. And this is a power plant. The construction had started during the time of the Shah of Iran, and then it was curtailed under the Ayatollah Khomeini and only started again recently. There is a program for civilian atomic power in Iran. And Iran, unlike many of the other countries in the world, there are 31 countries that have nuclear power plants and nuclear facilities. Iran has the capability of having uranium within its borders, and so can have a full stage processing of the uranium necessary for running its nuclear power plants. Ralph.
Seymour Hersh picks up the theme on January 17, 2005, in a report on CNN. The Bush administration has been carrying out secret reconnaissance missions to learn about nuclear, chemical, and missile sites in Iran in preparation for airstrikes there, journalist Seymour Hersh said Sunday. The goal is to identify and isolate three dozen and perhaps more such targets that will be destroyed by precision strikes and commando raids, he wrote in the New Yorker magazine, which published his article in editions that will be on newsstands Monday, CNN continues. Now, what's instructive about this is that the secret missions in Iran have been authorized to prevent embarrassment in the event of military action there. The planning for Iran is going ahead, even though Iraq is a mess, Hersh disclosed. There's a chance to do something in Iran by summer to get intelligence on the site. The guys on the inside really want to do this. And Hersh proceeds to identify the inside people, quote, as the neoconservative civilian leadership in the Pentagon, including Rumsfeld, Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, Undersecretary of Defense Doug Feith, the sort of war hawks that we talk about in connection with the war in Iraq. The next step is Iran. It's definitely there. They're definitely planning. The article continues.
Now, we're going to go into the subject of this article because this January 17th article by Seymour Hersh is a seminal piece in terms of the development of the uncivil war within the ruling class. But I should note right away that Hersh went on CNN on the 17th, and that was the date that his article appeared on the Internet, the New Yorker article. And then just 3 days later, on January 20th, on MSNBC, we have Vice President Dick Cheney, only a few days before the second inauguration, after the election, the re-election of President Bush, Dick Cheney goes on Don Imus's program, Imus in the Morning, and he goes on with his wife, and this is not a typical forum for Cheney, and he says, quote, that Iran is right at the top of the list of global trouble spots, But Cheney is worried that Israel might strike to shut down Tehran's nuclear programs. Quote, "One of the concerns people have is that Israel might do it without being asked," end quote. And given the fact that Iran has a stated policy, Cheney says, that their objective is the destruction of Israel, the Israelis might well decide to act first and let the rest of the world worry about cleaning up the diplomatic mess afterwards. Now, keep this in mind as Ralph continues to discuss what Seymour Hersh is doing on CNN and with his article in The New Yorker. Ralph.
Well, as everybody understood, and certainly Seymour Hersh did, Cheney's declaration that the Israelis may well choose to do this on their own if we don't go in there and do it for them and with them was a very clear threat to those within ruling class circles who had expressed reservations about the consequences of taking out Iran with weaponry and attacks that entail not only preemptive strike, but nuclear weapons as well. As Hersh stated, administration officials have chosen not to include other points of view in their deliberations, such as predictions that any U.S. attack will provoke a wave of nationalism that will unite Iranians against the United States, with consequences in Iraq that are far, far-reaching, with 7 million Shia who look to Iran, who are organized into Badiji militia, and who will be mobilized in numbers that will absolutely overwhelm and swamp U.S. forces there. Here's Hersh. "As people say to me, when it comes to meetings about this issue, if you don't drink the Kool-Aid, you can't go to the meetings. And the plans are not limited to Iran." Quote, "The president has signed a series of findings and executive author orders authorizing secret commando groups and special forces units to conduct such covert operations against targets in as many as 10 nations in the Middle East and South Asia," he wrote. "Under the secret plans, this war will be led by the Pentagon. The power of the CIA will be reduced. It's a great victory for Donald Rumsfeld, a bureaucratic victory," Hersh told CNN. "Since the summer of 2002, he's been advocating, let me run this war, not the CIA. We do it better. We send our boys in. We don't have to tell their local military commanders. We don't have to tell ambassadors. We don't have to tell the CIA station. We go in and work with the bad guys, and we see what we can do and what we find out."
Ralph, in Hersh's article, The Coming Wars, and it's available on the Internet still, it was, again, posted on the Internet first, beginning of this year, January 17th, 2005, for The New Yorker, and it's The Coming Wars, What the Pentagon Can Now Do in Secret. And in it, he reveals, going back to the Israelis, that Israel has three submarines capable of launching cruise missiles and has equipped some of its aircraft with additional fuel tanks, putting the Israeli F-16 fighters within the range of most Iranian targets. And the Israelis have considered that they can take out three-quarters of what they can call the dispersed nuclear facilities, that is, throughout Iran. Iran has learned from the Iraqi experience and has dispersed its nuclear plants, the conversion plants, the conversion of uranium to the different stages necessary to fuel the nuclear power plants, as well as its nuclear power plant. They're dispersed throughout Iran, and that they can still take out three-quarters of the potential targets and destroy them from the air. And Hersh also notes that the U.S. Central Command in Tampa, Florida, has revised its military war plans to provide for maximum ground and air invasion of Iran, that it is decided that troops could move in by ground now from Afghanistan or Iraq because of the change in the global situation in the Middle East after 9/11. Where the U.S. now has control in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and so can deploy ground troops through those countries, and that commando units could be introduced through new bases in the Central Asian republics, the STANs, where previously they had to enter Iran by sea or the Persian Gulf or the Gulf of Oman. So these are very complex war plans that have been prepared by Israel and by the United States. Ralph.
Yes, Maya, and keep in mind what Hirsch said. That was not a minor comment when he said nobody who isn't drinking the Kool-Aid is allowed to go into the meetings. That's a reference to mass suicide, the so-called suicide. It was actually a CIA hit. That's another story in Jonestown when members of the Jones, Reverend Jones cult were supposedly given Kool-Aid, which they all drank, and it was laced with cyanide and with poisons that killed them. If you don't drink the Kool-Aid, you can't go to the meetings. Hirsch is signaling that there is a broad, profound disaffection from sectors of the ruling class about those who drink the Kool-Aid and are taking the U.S. into a suicidal course.
Now,
here's how, excuse me, Maya, here's how he lays it out in the article that you're citing. The government consultants with ties to the Pentagon state that the Defense Department, under the leadership of Douglas Feith, has been working with Israeli planners and consultants. This is a joint Israeli-U.S. operation. The Pentagon's contingency plans for a broader invasion of Iran are being updated. But this is an Israeli neocon Douglas Feith operation involving Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, and Libby, and Pearl, and the architects of the Project for a New American Century.
Ralph, going back to our programs on I. Lewis Libby and the indictment of Libby, we have to note that, again, as then, here in this article by Seymour Hirsch, he has the revelations of high intelligence officials and an unnamed retired four-star general who told Hirsch that, quote, it's a global free fire zone. We should also note that something interesting has happened since January when Hirsch made this and other revelations in his articles through the New Yorker and his interviews throughout the media. Mentioning, let's go back a bit, even before then, when we have March 2003 and the forced resignation of Richard Pearl, who was the chair of the Defense Policy Review Board, and that had followed accusations by none other than Seymour Hirsch in The New Yorker that Pearl had faced conflicts of interest between his work on the board, which was unpaid, but subject to government ethics rules, and his private business dealings. That is, that he had been retained by the bankrupt telecommunications firm Global Crossing to help smooth over government approval of the purchase of two Asian firms, a deal under scrutiny by the Department of Defense officials, and that was Hirsch's report. So here we have, again, January 2005, and again, revelations from high intelligence officials, meaning the CIA, and four-star generals about the U.S. plans prepared by Wolfowitz and Feith, the neocons, the JINSA, PNAC folks, close comrades of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and Vice President Dick Cheney.
And deeply tied to the Likud apparatus and JINSA and the entire apparatus of the Zionist state, which has taken as its project forward action to dismantle all of the nations of the Middle East and their ethnic and religious components. But what we have here, Maya...
Ralph, let me continue of what happens in the next months before you go on with that analysis, because we have very, like a month or so later, the news that Paul Wolfowitz, the Undersecretary of Defense, is going to resign from his position, and he's going to be appointed the World Bank President. And in fact, he is appointed World Bank President in April of 2005. And then another surprise announcement, and that is that Douglas Feith will resign as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, very Douglas Feith, who had been working with the Israelis to pick targets in Iran, and he resigns in August of 2005. And then we have the recent indictment of I. Lewis Libby.
And preceding that, of course, Richard Perle was made to resign as chair of Defense Policy Review Board, and that followed the accusations, as you say, by Seymour Hersh. And what is important about understanding the role of such figures as Seymour Hersh, who has long been a conduit for Central Intelligence Agency disclosures, when Seymour Hersh exposes Abu Ghraib, when Seymour Hersh, exposes plans for a direct coordinated assault by the Pentagon and Israel on Iran, when he discloses, he does in this article, an undercover unit known as the Gray Fox, given a new code name from the Army to the Special Operations Command. Gray Fox, which was formerly assigned to SOCOM, now under Rumsfeld's directive, taken away from CIA, taken away from covert ops that are associated with CIA, and handed over to special units of the Pentagon directly answerable to Rumsfeld and the neocons. Here's how it's described. They are giving the Pentagon complete control over the CIA's own elite paramilitary units, which had operated covertly in spots around the world for decades. It seems like it's going to happen, Howard Hart, who was chief of the CIA's Paramilitary Operations Division before retiring, told me. There was other evidence of this Pentagon encroachment. Two CIA clandestine officers, Vince Canestraro and Philip Giraldi, who publish intelligence brief, a newsletter for their business clients, reported on the existence of a broad presidential finding that allows the Pentagon, quote, to operate unilaterally in countries where there is a perception of clear and evident threat. These are countries friendly to the United States, major trading partners. The countries include Algeria, Sudan, Yemen, Syria, and Malaysia. I was told by the former high-level intelligence officials, Tunisia is also on the list. Giraldi, who served 3 years in military intelligence before joining CIA, stated, I am troubled by this military expansion over covert assignments. They can't handle the cover. They have a different mindset. They got to handle new roles and get into foreign cultures. These operations had always been run out of the agency. Now special operations officers have serious misgivings. Rumsfeld and his key deputies, Stephen Cambone, the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, and Army Lieutenant General William G. Jerry Boykin, will be part of the chain of command. Boykin is the person, by the way, who talks about a Christian crusade against the unbelievers. But leaving that aside, here is a central and defining aspect of this Hersh disclosure with CIA authorization. Quote, under Rumsfeld's new approach, I have been informed, U.S. military operatives will be permitted to pose abroad as corrupt foreign businessmen seeking to buy contraband items to be used in nuclear weapons systems. According to the Pentagon advisors, citizens will be recruited and asked to join up with guerrillas and terrorists. This will involve organizing and carrying out combat operations and even terrorist activity. Operations will take place in nations in which there's an American diplomatic mission with an ambassador and a CIA station chief. The ambassador and the CIA station chief will not necessarily have a need to know under the Pentagon's current interpretation of reporting requirements. This will enable these special forces to set up what is called action teams in target countries. Now, what's instructive about this, if you look at what is being disclosed here by Hersh, they're talking about false flag operations, faking and staging terrorist attacks, faking and staging guerrilla attacks carried out by the Pentagon operatives themselves in order to provide the opportunity to carry out predetermined preemptive strike policies. This is exactly what William Arkin had disclosed with P2OG. Here you have really, there's no question about it, the exact model of what 9/11 is about, of what the bombings in London and Madrid are about, what the staged operations in Iraq that target civilian populations are about, and it is being, the cover is blown by Seymour Hersh in the coming wars with consequences that we will begin to describe. Maya?
Well, the consequences were the uncivil war that emerged, which was to diffuse the neocons, because this is becoming the entire axis of evil, and the war in Iraq, and then the potential ground and air war against Iran and Syria, as we reported over and again in times past, with who's next, and we went through details of the setting the stage against Iran and Syria. And this leads on throughout the Middle East. And in this coming wars, again, we have Hirsch talking about the consultants, the unnamed government consultants and the unnamed intelligence folks, officials, the high levels, as he says, former high-level intelligence officials told me, or the government consultant told me, all these unnamed confidential sources telling him in his, quote, private discussions, that they've been urging a limited attack on Iran because they believe it would lead to a toppling of the religious leadership. This is the same story we heard from the neocons and also William Kristol and the Evening Standard folks, all the folks that were talking about the attacks on Iran, the attacks on North Korea, even attacks on China. They have been saying that if you have a limited strike, you are going to then have a toppling of the leadership, in this case, the toppling of the mullahs in Iran. But this is the comment of Flint Leverett, a Middle East scholar at the Zionist Saban Center for Middle East Policy and also at the Brookings Institution. Quote, the idea that an American attack on Iran's nuclear facilities would produce a popular uprising is extremely ill-informed. That when he says that if you do attack Iran, then the Iranians will perceive the attacks on the sites, the nuclear sites, as attacks on their ambitions to be a major regional player. But most of all, what the Iranians, even though they don't agree with the mullahs, what they will do is understand that this is an attack on Iranian sovereignty. Ralph.
Yes, Maya. And folks, they are not. They are talking about high-level ranking decision makers in the ruling class. And here we have Richard Cheney. Oh, dear. Richard Cheney, who is exposed in the report by MSNBC and by PBS on January 20th, 2005. Cheney. Iran is at the top of the list on trouble spots. He asks Israel to carry out the attack. U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney stated Thursday, Iran is right at the top of the list, and stated Israel will strike to shut down Tehran's nuclear programs. One of the concerns people have is that Israel would do it without being asked. Cheney, who led the chorus of voices calling for Saddam Hussein's ouster, NBC and PBS report, ahead of the March 2003 of invasion of Iraq, told NBC in an interview, quote, given the fact that Iran is a stated policy, the Israelis may well decide to act first, let the rest of the world worry about cleaning up the diplomatic wet mess afterwards, he said. Zbigniew Brzezinski was quick to comment. Cheney wants Israel to carry out this attack. Iran is ambiguous. The issue is not tyranny, it's nuclear weapons. And this vice president, in a strange parallel statement, has stated that the Israelis may do it. In fact, Cheney is using language which is a justification and an encouragement for the Israelis to stage it. Unquote. That's Brzezinski drawing obvious lessons and conclusions from this charade of Cheney, concerned about that Israelis will do it on their own if the U.S. doesn't step in, because what he is actually doing is signaling the necessity for such an attack, as Brzezinski is so clear in establishing.
And this is reiterated September 30th, 2005, in an article in the Washington Times by David Sands. Israelis urge U.S. to stop Iran's nuke goals. The United States and its allies must act to stop Iran's nuclear programs by force if necessary, is added in emphasis, because conventional diplomacy will not work. Three senior Israeli lawmakers from across the political spectrum warned yesterday. And they quote Ariel Eldad, a member of the Israel's National Union Party, who was part of a delegation of Knesset members that visited Washington, and said that Iran will not be deterred quite, a quote, by anything short of a threat of force. And Yuval Steinitz, the chairman of the Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee, said was that Iran has to be told that there's no chance they will ever see the fruits of a nuclear program. Threats of sanctions and isolation alone will not do it. And Yosef Lapid from the Shinui Party in the Knesset added, Israel, quote, will not live under the threat of an Iranian nuclear bomb, end quote. All of this going on, despite the fact that there has been no evidence by the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, that Iran is anywhere near or has the capability or the intention of producing nuclear weapons. Ralph, before we continue, it's time to have a short station break, and we'll be with you right afterwards. This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Thieves Fall Out Over Iran, Uncivil War Within the Ruling Class. Ralph.
Well, Maya, I think what's very instructive about this Washington Times piece, and as we'll see, it's been orchestrated in medium after medium across the world, and specifically in the United States, is that they're engaged, basically, the Zionists declaring their long-standing intent to take out Iran, and to do it now with the neocons in the United States at their side, they're engaged in a little charade of soft cop, hard cop. You got to do it because we can't do it. If you do it, we'll be caught up in something. All the while, this is a collusion. Our mission is to point out the dangers we see to ourselves and to our friends. This is what your Mr. Lapid had stated. And then these three lawmakers met with their U.S. counterparts and senior administration officials and asked if they thought their message got through. Mr. Steinitz said, "We were not talking to the walls," unquote. So it's very clear here what is being set up here in this little public relations charade of the Zionists being wringing their hands about the necessity to do things on their own if the U.S. doesn't join in. And William Arkin has added a dimension to this, which we have discussed on Taking Aim with great particularity, but now begins to show itself in all its significance. Washington Post, May 15th, 2005, not just a last resort, a global strike plan with a nuclear option. This is William Arkin in the Washington Post. Early last summer, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld approved a top-secret interim global strike alert order directing the military to assume and maintain readiness to attack hostile countries, specifically Iran and North Korea. 2 months later, Lieutenant General Bruce Carlson, commander of the 8th Air Force, told a reporter that his fleet of B-52 and B-2 bombers had changed the way its way of operating so that they are ready to carry out these missions. We are at the point where we are essentially on alert. They're on alert for Iran. Carlson stated in an interview with the Shreveport, Louisiana Times, "We have the capacity to plan and execute global strikes." His forces were the U.S. Strategic Command's focal point for global strike and can execute the attack in a half a day or less. And this Arkin piece is instructive. In the secret world, he writes of military planning, global strike has become the term of art to describe a specific preemptive attack. When military officials refer to global strike, they stress its conventional elements. However, now global strike includes the nuclear option. And global strike has become one of the core missions today under this administration of an Omaha-based strategic command, or STRATCOM. STRATCOM oversaw the nation's nuclear forces. Now it has responsibility for overseeing a global strike plan with both conventional and nuclear options. Both conventional and nuclear options. Bush spelled out the definition of a full-spectrum global strike in a January 2003 classified directive, describing it as a capability to deliver rapid, extended-range precision kinetic, nuclear, and non-kinetic elements in support of theater and national objectives. And here is the smoking gun as disclosed by William Arkin. This is part of a plan known as CONPLAN 80220-02. CONPLAN 80220 is different from other war plans. It posits a small-scale operation, no boots on the ground, and it anticipates scenarios, and that includes an all-out attack on Iran and one that includes a multidimensional bombing involving nuclear weapons. By employing all of the tricks in the U.S. arsenal to immobilize an enemy country, turning off the electricity, jamming and spoofing radars and communications, penetrating computer systems, garbling electronic commands, the global strike magnifies the impact of the bombing. The conclusion, therefore, of the nuclear weapons option is particularly disconcerting, writes Arkin. The global strike plan holds the nuclear option front and center. We cannot let our enemies strike first, President Bush declared in the National Security Strategy document. Here is a plan for deploying and using nuclear weapons, and indeed for setting the stage for not only using nuclear weapons in an attack on Iran, but for preparing the ground for using them against any country perceived to be a threat to the interests of the ruling class.
Well, Ralph, the Nuclear Posture Review was published in 2003, and since then, Jim Loeb notes that a March document by the Joint Chiefs of Staff was recently posted to the Pentagon's website. It hasn't yet been adopted, but they are passing it by the public to see what the reaction will be. And this March document is called Doctrine for Joint Nuclear Operations. It's an updating of the Nuclear Posture Review and again foresees preemptive nuclear strikes. Now, all this being exposed, particularly the work of William Arkin and Seymour Hersh, is the counterbalance to the neocon agenda. We have the elements of the ruling class that are becoming more and more worried, not worried about having nuclear weapons, because it was under the Bill Clinton administration that there was an expansion of money and, you know, for funding and research about nuclear weapons. But it's a question of how they are used. And that's what's at issue. And that's the question that Seymour Hersh and William Arkin are posing, the uncivil war within the ruling class.
Well, Maya, we can deal with the fact that the Clinton administration, the Democratic Party, and the essentially the center of the ruling class, of which Bush Sr. and Scowcroft are spokespersons, had prepared for the expansion of nuclear capacity. Not only that, the modernization of the warheads, but the development of whole new delivery systems, which represents the commitment to hundreds of billions of dollars for a decades-long refurbishing of the nuclear arsenal and its delivery system, new missile capacities, payloads, and what have you. Chapter and verse we will be giving in the either in this show or in part two. But what we're, as you point out, we're looking at here is the uncivil war that's unfolding, because it's one thing for the ruling class to invest hundreds of billions of dollars of our of the sweat labor of the working class in the addiction to arms and to prepare the nuclear arsenal so that the U.S. can terrorize anyone in the world with the threat of the use of these weapons. And it's quite another thing to be actively calling for and preparing for their generalized use. Here is William Arkin again in the Los Angeles Times. The nuclear option in Iraq, the U.S. has lowered the bar for using the ultimate weapon. And he again, citing STRATCOM and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, designates an entire transformation of policy in which preemptive strike is linked with the plan to actually deploy nuclear weapons in targets such as Iran and Libya and North Korea. Reviewed by the Los Angeles Times, STRATCOM's Omaha headquarters, among small teams in Washington and at Vice President Dick Cheney's undisclosed location in Pennsylvania, the current nuclear planning with military officers has already designed its targets and its time of use. This document of William Arkin, like the disclosures of Seymour Hersh, is inside information fed to them, it becomes very clear, by the Central Intelligence Agency itself on behalf of those who see this as a reckless endangerment of the interests of the nuclear of the ruling class itself. And the Jim Loeb piece,
Ralph, the Jim Loeb is September 14th, 2005. It's available on the Internet, on his archive, and he's an Interpress Service correspondent in Washington. It's also available at www.lewrockwell.com.
Well, Maya, in the Jim Loeb piece, Pentagon Foresees Preemptive Nuclear Strikes, carries on the disclosures of Seymour Hersh and William Arkin. The new doctrine reaffirms an aggressive nuclear posture of modernized nuclear weapons. According to Hans Christensen of the Natural Resources Defense Council, this new doctrine grants regional nuclear strike planning an increasingly expeditionary aura that threatens to make nuclear weapons another tool in the toolbox, he wrote last week in Arms Control Today. The result is nuclear preemption, which the new doctrine enshrines as the official U.S. joint nuclear doctrine for the first time. The doctrine is the latest in a series of documents adopted by the administration that has moved the U.S. away from the view that nuclear weapons should be used solely for the purposes of defense and deterrence. The new delivery systems for nuclear weapons are targeting China, North Korea, Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Libya. In a new view that was expounded by Bush himself in a national security strategy document, we will not let our enemies strike first. And then, as Christensen discloses, national security analyst William Arkin has exposed Rumsfeld's top-secret interim global strike alert order that directs the military to be prepared to strike adversaries, notably Iran and North Korea, with nuclear weapons. So we have here the alarm being sounded, and it's an alarm on behalf of a sector of the class that considers this policy for a calamity for the rulers themselves.
And, Ralph, to bring it back to Iran, you mentioned before Philip Giraldi, who is the associate. He's a former CIA officer, and he also had worked at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and he works for Vincent Canestraro, who, and together with him, they publish an intelligence newsletter that goes out to businessmen, but they also are consultants, and Canestraro had been the head of counterterrorism at the CIA. And in August, in the American Conservative, Giraldi reported that Vice President Dick Cheney's office, quote, had tasked the United States Strategic Command with drawing up a contingency plan for, quote, a large-scale air assault on Iran, employing both conventional and tactical nuclear weapons. And this is what we were reporting before. Many of the targets are hardened or deep underground and could not be taken out by conventional weapons, hence the nuclear option, he wrote. So we have, again, the sectors of the ruling class, especially elements of the CIA, worried about the use of preemptive nuclear strikes against Iran.
Well, Maya, here is Paul Richter, again in the Los Angeles Times, March 9, 2002, U.S. works up a plan for using nuclear arms. The Bush administration has directed the military to prepare plans to use nuclear weapons against at least seven countries and to use smaller nuclear weapons, to build smaller nuclear weapons for use in battlefield situations, according to a classified Pentagon report obtained by the Los Angeles Times, leaked to the Los Angeles Times. The secret report was provided on January 8th, stating that the Pentagon must be prepared to use nuclear weapons against China, Russia, Iraq, North Korea, Iran, Libya, and Syria. And the response on the part of those who are representing broad sectors of the class, this is dynamite, said James Sirincione.
Now, Ralph, that's too-
Carnegie Endowment. I cannot imagine what countries are going to be saying. They are trying desperately to find new uses for nuclear weapons, said John Isaacs, president of the Council for a Living World. This is very, very dangerous. Dr. Strangelove is clearly alive in the Pentagon.
Ralph, that's the Los Angeles Times, 2002. We've quoted the articles also from 2003. And here we are in 2005 as Jim Loeb is written and has reported on the new doctrine for joint nuclear operations that has appeared on the Pentagon's website, that they are still talking about the use of tactical nuclear weapons, and specifically preparing the use of them against Iran. And we have John Bolton, another one of the warmongers, the World War IV warmongers. First, he was the Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security. And in that position on June 24, 2004, provided testimony before the House International Relations Subcommittee for the Middle East and Central Asia. Now, as you know, Bolton is the UN, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, as President Bush appointed him outside of congressional hearings when Congress was not seated. And at the time when Bolton was making this testimony, he was outlining the U.S. case against Iran and Iran's continuing pursuit of weapons of mass destruction. Does this sound familiar? The setting the stage for the attack on Iraq. And we have Bolton saying and providing detailed comments on Iran's extensive covert nuclear weapons program and its efforts of chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, and ballistic missiles, quote, pose grave threats to international security. Iran's pursuit of these deadly weapons, despite its adherence to treaties that ban them, marks it as a rogue state, and it will remain so until it completely, verifiably, and irreversibly dismantles its WMD-related programs. On and on. And later, October 15th, 2005, as he's the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Bolton continues with this formulation and accuses Iran of nuclear plans in an interview with the BBC.
Yes, that's 1 week ago, actually, that Bolton told the BBC that Iran was preparing nuclear arms to intimidate the rest of the Middle East and to supply them to terrorists. And indeed, as you were indicating in the major presentation that Bolton made as Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security, which was distributed by the Department of State, the claim was made by Bolton for the Bush administration that we have imposed trade sanctions involving weapons of mass destruction transfers to Iran over 50 times. Iran has a clandestine program to produce nuclear weapons, and we have been warning publicly about Tehran's nuclear weapons ambitions now for over a decade. The drumbeat for the preemptive strike, this is, of course, as you indicate, the reason why the revolt was prepared against Bolton by Republicans answerable to George Bush Sr. and to Scowcroft, and by Democrats who are aligned with the Joseph Biden objection or resistance to the neocon escalating their World War IV agenda. So that's why we're very clear about this, and we will develop this in great amplitude in the second part of this series. The stratagems of Bush Sr., of Scowcroft, of the Democratic Party, as spoken for by Joseph Biden, for the both for the expansion of the nuclear arsenal and for the development of an appropriate policy for such countries as Iran, is much as they did in the preparations for the first Gulf War. Starve them out with sanctions, wait for the opportunity to stage a putsch, and bomb if necessary in relation to that, but don't commit massive U.S. troop involvement to an occupation where you have to face an enraged and mobilized population in guerrilla insurrection. Here, indeed, is the Reuters' November 13th disclosure of the neocon persistence. New evidence has suggested that Iran has made significant progress in its pursuit of nuclear weapons, and this strengthens the case for international action with respect to Tehran. Now, what is, of course, very instructive about this, and I don't think we have time to elaborate it here, but we will next week, is that the evidence pertaining to the development of a nuclear weapons program for Iran is as fake as the weapons of mass destruction were for Iraq. Notwithstanding the sovereign right of Iran or any country in the world to develop weapons systems in their own defense, when both the United States monopolizes nuclear technology and threatens the use of these weapons on a constant basis, when the Zionist state has a huge arsenal of over 200 H-bomb missiles and targets almost the capitals of every Middle Eastern state. But what we are addressing here is the disputes that are unfolding within the ruling class, and the stakes are high. That's what the sidelining of the Central Intelligence Agency is about, and that's what the systematic targeting of neocon individuals has been reflective about of as well.
Well, Ralph, it's important to bring in, as we close this program, the breaking news discussed by Newsweek in its latest edition and presented again by Jim Loeb in an article, Realists Tighten Grip as Talks Open with Iran, dated November 29th.
Today's date.
Today. And the Newsweek article is about bringing down the troop commitment in Iraq. And within it is an interview with Khalilzad, the ambassador to Iraq, Zalmay Khalilzad, who had been the ambassador to Afghanistan. And in it, Khalilzad notes that he's been authorized by the president, by President Bush, to engage the Iranians as I engaged them in Afghanistan directly. There will be meetings, and there's also a departure and adjustment in U.S. policy. The decision to reopen direct talks with Iran has not yet reacted. Iran has not yet reacted to Khalilzad's announcement, and the reason for this is the role of Iran in Iraq. And that is something that has been discussed at length and we'll go into in our next part by the Center for Nonproliferation Studies, because they discuss what a preemptive attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, what those consequences would be, and particularly what the consequences would be in Iraq.
Well, Maya, it's very clear here. Here is the comment of Juan Cole, the University of Michigan Middle East historian, as cited by Jim Loeb in this report today. It is a sign of desperation. It is a recognition that the administration needs Iran to get out of Iraq. To the extent that you can have a soft landing in Iraq, the Iranians have to be involved. Indeed, Ambassador Khalilzad depicted the decision as part of a general strategy long urged by realists such as George Bush Sr.'s National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft and Democrats, including the party's ranking foreign policy spokesman Senator Joseph Biden. We have to enlist the cooperation of Baghdad's neighbor to stabilize Iraq sufficiently to permit a substantial drawdown of U.S. troops. That goal has become far more urgent as public support for the U.S. presence in Iran has plummeted and as confidence in Bush's performance and in the general war on terror declines. Bush's poll numbers have dropped to levels not seen since the Richard Nixon administration. And what this article discloses is that the uncivil war, of which the indictment of Libby by this special prosecutor Fitzgerald, the very man who was involved in the in a collusion in the 1993 bombings of the World Trade Center and the prosecution of a patsy, these CIA-sponsored ruling class determined resistances to the neocon agenda reflect a division about the long-term strategy of the rulers, no less brutal in either instance, but the war of the knives, the war of the long knives unfolds before us. As we like to say, the technique of infamy is to invent two lies and get people arguing heatedly over which one of them is true. Iran is in their target, whether they enlist it for temporary support or not. But how it's done, and at what cost to the ruling class itself, is a vital issue about which they debate, kill their rivals, as the Kennedy execution itself disclosed. Next week, we will elaborate on precisely what these issues are dividing the class and how they play out for the oppressed peoples of the world.
I'd like to make a small adjustment. Next week we are preemptive for a fund drive for the Pacific Archives. We'll be returning in 2 weeks with the continuation of the thieves' fallout over Iran, uncivil war within the ruling class. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. You can reach us at Taking Aim at PacBell, that's PACBELL.net, and visit our archive at www.takingaim.info. And our programs are also archived on the new WBAI archive at www.wbai.org. We'll be with you again in 2 weeks.
Tatan ta chinda karo, tatan ta. Kilo nokni.